Hello, I'm Nick Clark. This is Counting the Cost on Al Jazeera, your look at the world of business and economics. This week, Europe's population is aging, and France is among many nations struggling to keep retirement schemes afloat. So, should workers retire much older? And who foots the pension bill? Also this week, rising interest rates are straining the budgets of countries already in debt. Egypt and Pakistan are among nations vulnerable to default. Will they implement much-needed reforms? And India's business tycoon, Gautam Adani, lost billions after fraud claims by a US investment firm. We explore what's next for the Adani empire. So, Europeans are living longer, and as the continent's population grows older, the number of people who contribute to retirement schemes shrinks. And that's pushing many countries to reform their pension systems to balance the books. In France, a proposed bill has proven hugely unpopular. The government says that increasing the retirement age is vital to prevent the system from going bankrupt. But unions and left-wing politicians, they're not convinced. The controversy over the reform centres on raising the retirement age by 2 years to 64 by 2030. The bill would also increase the minimum number of years that people must pay into the system to get a full pension, from 42 to 43 years. It also includes an increase in the minimum pension to around $1,300 a month and allows those who begin working at younger ages to retire earlier. Well, more than a million people took to the streets for the second nationwide strike against the pension reforms. Reforming the social welfare system is Emmanuel Macron's signature policy, and he's defended his plan as essential. We spoke to Joël Ould, a taxi driver nearing retirement in Paris.
I am 70 years old. I've been driving taxis for 42 years, and if all goes well, I'll be retiring in 2 months. I work 11 hours a day. Sometimes I try to do Saturday morning as well. But it's not always easy if you want family time. I was happy working as a taxi driver. I organized the hours to suit me. I didn't think about my retirement. But things changed with the pandemic and the crisis that followed. We had days with barely 20% of our usual turnover. I did the calculations, and my pension will be about $1,000 a month. My wife and I are going to struggle to make it to the end of the month. She gets about $320. We wanted children, so she didn't work much. And when she did, she was miserable. She was exploited more than anything else. I feel sick to my stomach because now, more and more, I am confronted with real life. I am approaching retirement, and it feels like it's all been for nothing. I am scared, but I say to myself, fortunately, there are these reforms, and they will increase pensions to $1,300. I have to say I am almost happy, because for me that's an extra $270, which is something. But then, to make people work for longer, obviously, everyone knows that if you have to, you'll do it. But you have to be physically able, you have to be strong, and it's not easy. It all depends on the job. And many jobs psychologically or emotionally destroy you. And then you need to find or keep a job. If you're already 50, 55 years old, it's difficult to find work. So, at almost 70, can you imagine? You go to the recruiters, and when you tell them your age, they say, "Sir, it's time to stop working." And I think they are right. It's time to stop.
Well, in fact, France's retirement age is among the lowest in Europe. The country spent around 14% of GDP on state pensions in 2019. But it is Italy who has the most generous system, spending almost 16% of its GDP on pensions. And that's followed by Greece, which plans to increase pensions this year for the first time in more than a decade. Germany spends almost 10% of its GDP on pensions, and it's among nations lifting the retirement age to 67. The UK is reportedly lifting it to 68. Iceland spends the smallest amount on retirees in Europe at 2.9% of GDP, yet it is ranked among the top three systems. Well, joining me now from Paris is Philippe Vechter, who is the director of the Economic Research Department at Ostrom Asset Management. Philippe, welcome to the show. The first thing, even if France raises the retirement age to 64, that's still lower than many developed economies. So why such uproar?
Well, it's a very complicated situation in France. You know, the question is, why doing a retirement reform now? We have had a pandemic, we have had a surge in inflation, and so it's probably not a good moment to do that. That's the first reason. The second reason is that there is a strong political reason for that, because President Macron has not the majority at the National Assembly, and it's a way to limit his power. And third, the reform that will take place probably is probably not well scheduled in a way that people who are who will retire rapidly will have to postpone the moment, the age of retirement. So if you are 61, if you are 55, you have to work longer. Mm. And usually in retirement reform, it takes time for doing to change the situation. So that's all these reasons that make the social unrest we see currently in France.
Right. The thing is, the money has got to come from somewhere, isn't it? Because if you look at it, the OECD says that France has very high expected years of life in retirement. It ranks second in men at 23 and a half years and third in women at 27.1 years. And that's compared across the continent. And someone has to pay for that. The money has to come from somewhere. So people need to keep working longer, don't they?
Many people agree on the reducing the length of the retirement period and working longer. There is no discussion on this point. There is two discussions. One is why doing it now, mm-hmm. and the second is that the former retirement reform that was voted in 2014 has just taken place in 2020. How can we manage these two reforms? The former one, which will continue and probably will accelerate, and the new one. That's complicated.
So what's your answer to that? What's the solution? What should the government do?
The solution is to probably not doing it clearly now. It's not necessary to do it now, even for budget reason, for budget balance reasons. That's not a necessity now. The question is, on which parameter do we play on? You know, in retirement scheme, you have three parameters. The number of years of contribution, the level of the pension for retirees, and the level of contribution. That's three parameters. And the question is how to mix all of them.
The government says that lifting the retirement age will help raise the employment rate. That's got to be a good thing.
We have to demonstrate that. It has not been shown everywhere in the world. You know, it's complicated. You know, in France, people above 50 years old have a very low employment rate for many reasons. This has to change, and with this reform, we have to have a plan to make how this employment rate for the people age above 55 will increase. There is nothing about that, so that's a very weird situation. And the reform seems to be not totally completed. You know, at the start, we are not sure that the situation is the whole point of the reform has been worked on definitely. So that's why it's complicated.
One final thing. It struck me just reading through some facts beforehand that we talked about Iceland, 3%. Just 3% of GDP is spent on pensions, yet it's among the best schemes in the world. How do they make that work there?
Countries like Iceland, like Denmark, have a very specific retirement scheme linked to the fact that it's very small countries, mm-hmm. not as diversified as France. So it's easier to have a kind of consensus on different topics. And retirement is one of it. And so it's a kind of collective agreement we can have in a small country, not in large countries like France or others.
Philippe Vechter, appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Currencies sinking to record lows, dwindling foreign reserves and ballooning debt. Like many developing nations, the economic crises in Egypt and Pakistan have been aggravated by the war in Ukraine. But other factors have also had an impact, among them the role of military-run enterprises in the economy and investments in big and costly infrastructure projects. Egypt has a population of more than 100 million people. One third of them live in poverty. They can't even afford basic foods like eggs and cooking oil, which have doubled in price. The country imposed import restrictions and banks limited foreign currency withdrawals to try and conserve scarce dollars. Pakistan is also struggling with rising inflation and is facing an acute balance of payments crisis with less than 3 weeks' worth of import cover in its foreign reserves. Egypt and Pakistan have both resorted to the International Monetary Fund to help ease their financial problems. Cairo committed to reducing the military's role in the economy as part of the $3 billion IMF package. It also agreed to move to a flexible currency exchange rate and slow down public investment in national projects. Pakistan has also taken steps to revive its stalled $7 billion fund. Among them is easing control on the currency and hiking up petrol and diesel prices. OK, from Karachi, I'm joined now by Akdas Afzal, who's an assistant professor of economics at Habib University there. And Mr. Afzal, welcome to the programme. First up, tell us more about Pakistan and Egypt's situation, their similarities and how they've reached this point.
Well, thank you for having me on the show, Nick. The economic crisis in Egypt and Pakistan has many similarities. First of all, both crises came about in the immediate aftermath of the hostilities between Russia and Ukraine. And you might remember that this crisis led to a commodity super cycle. In the case of Egypt, there was a massive capital flight of about $20 billion. And then Egypt was importing very expensive wheat because it's one of the, it's actually the biggest cereal importer in the world. And those prices went up in the immediate aftermath of the Russia-Ukraine conflict. In the case of Pakistan, elevated oil prices led to a classic balance of payments crisis. And initially, Pakistan tried to deal with it by freezing imports, but very soon, both countries were forced to turn back to the IMF for assistance so that the IMF could assist them in stabilizing their economies.
So the efforts that both countries have now made to try and minimize the risk, will they work?
Well, yes and no. The efforts that were made by Egypt, primarily by turning to friendly Arab countries that poured in about $13 to $15 billion into the Egyptian coffers. Initially, it worked, but later on, it did not work because they then had to turn to the IMF. In the case of Pakistan, again, Pakistan tried to freeze the exchange rate so as to get a handle over imported inflation. But they realized that because of this policy decision and because of the overall political instability in Pakistan, inflows basically dried up and they were also forced to turn to the IMF for assistance.
When it comes to devaluations, why was it necessary to do that and how hard was that for people on the street?
Well, the basic reason has to do with the conditions of the IMF that requires exchange rate in both Egypt and Pakistan to be determined by market forces. And yes, it has been extremely painful for people, common people. In the case of Pakistan, inflation is already topping out at 28%, which is highest in 50 years, mind you. In the case of Egypt, inflation is topping out at 25%. If we look back at the case of Pakistan, this massive inflation, highest in 50 years, also worst floods this country has seen in its history, Pakistani economists calculate this is going to push an extra 20 million people into poverty. So this is going to bring about a lot of issues in terms of social unrest, more political instability and polarization.
Egypt has committed to reducing the military's role in the economy. Will that happen? Will it work?
Well, the IMF has asked specifically for the Egyptian state or the military-owned businesses to to extricate themselves only to strategic sectors. I think this is not going to work in the short term or the medium term, because when it comes to Egypt, almost two-thirds of the GDP is connected with state or military-owned businesses. And this creates a number of different problems for Egypt. For instance, it mitigates against innovation and growth. Many private sector businesses don't want to compete with military-owned businesses because these businesses have links in the corridors of power. So this, like I said, mitigates against innovation and growth. If Egypt were somehow to, you know, get its military out of its economy only by a few percentage points, I think that would open up the space for entrepreneurship, for innovation, and for more growth.
So that would give the private sector more opportunity to get involved in both countries, right?
That's right. So in the case of Pakistan, I mean, which is somewhat similar to, you know, the military's footprint, it's also very extensive in Pakistan. The military owns breakfast cereal factories and fertilizer factories. But the military's economic footprint in Pakistan is not as extensive as it is in Egypt. Of course, there have been criticisms for on the military's business connections for being opaque and for the fact that they allegedly pay less tax. So the situation is somewhat similar between Egypt and Pakistan in terms of the military or the state's footprint when it comes to the economy.
Similarity also in the way that both countries pour billions of dollars into mega projects. Does that kind of investment work?
I think that's more true in the case of Egypt, where, you know, this massive amount of money or billions of dollars have been poured into various vanity projects in the last 10 years. So anywhere from a new administrative capital to cities in the desert. What this has done is that this has not brought actual foreign direct investment, which would have created jobs and would have been a more sustainable source of hard currency. As opposed to that, what this does is that it brings about a classic balance of payments problem and mitigates against growth, as I mentioned previously to you.
As far as Egypt is concerned, Human Rights Watch has warned that the IMF deal will leave millions, the economic rights of millions, unprotected. Do you think that's right? That is the case?
I think that is definitely going to these the IMF conditionalities are definitely going to push more people into poverty, just like in Pakistan. Pakistani economists have calculated that almost 20 million people are going to be pushed, additional 20 million people are going to be pushed into poverty. So I think this is a very serious situation. This is going to create political unrest in both Egypt and Pakistan. At least in the case of Pakistan, the IMF has been somewhat supportive of Pakistan's main welfare program or social safety program, which is the Benazir Income Support Program.
All right, we'll have to leave it there. Akhdas Afzal, appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, India's Adani Group has built a fortune with investments across ports, airports, renewable energy and other industries. But the business empire has recently lost billions of dollars in stock market value. Its founder, Gautam Adani, slipped from a list of 10 of the world's wealthiest after fraud allegations against his companies by a US investment firm. The tumbling value of Adani Group is feared to have broader implications for Indian markets. The fallout comes after Hindenburg Research released a report accusing the Adani Group of engaging in decades of so-called brazen stock manipulation and accounting fraud. The firm dismissed the report as malicious and accused Hindenburg of a calculated attack. The American firm says that Adani's extensive rebuttal of its report ignored important allegations and was obfuscated by nationalism. Let's take this on to discuss all of this. I'm joined now by Dipanjan Mohan, who is an associate professor of economics at OP Jindal Global University and director for New Economics Studies. Dipanjan Mohan, welcome to the program. First up, Adani is a big, significant company in India. What happens here is a big deal, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely, Nick. And one of the key things we need to know is that Adani has been the poster boy of India's very aggressive bullish equity run, particularly from year 2020. I mean, his company's profits have soared like no other company. Even Elon Musk of Tesla or Jeff Bezos of Amazon have never seen their net worth go up at this pace. Adani's net worth was somewhere around $9.32 billion in September 2019, and this increased to $150 billion in September 2022. So it's a remarkable rise for any business person in India or Asia. He is the founder of one of the largest port operator in India. And more importantly, his business has pillion-rided to the Modi government's big agenda on infra investment, spending in areas of highways, ports, including for the infrastructure and investment you've seen the government making across most of logistical investment.
Okay, we'll come to that in a second. It's hugely significant, clearly. So what are the implications of this, and is there a danger of broader financial contagion?
Well, I think looking at what we see right now, we do see there is evidence of the Sensex and the stock market really responding in a sudden dip that happened over the last week. I would be erring on the side of caution by saying that the larger stock market trends, while they have gone in sync with what's happened to the Adani stock market share value collapse, and particularly the FPO not going well. But to look at a wider financial contagion, one needs to be very mindful of what's happening with businesses that are connected and have lent money to the Adani Group. I think that's where a lot of the problem may really lie. And with the information we have, I think the next few weeks are very vital.
So you mean the banks and the insurance companies and so forth?
Absolutely, absolutely. Because the borrowing strategy for the Adani Group in the last 3 years particularly has been looking beyond domestic banks. They've been tapping funds from overseas, mostly in the form of bonds. And the bank funding in India has been very restricted in the last 3 years. So there's a lot of exposure of Indian banks to Adani Group. But more importantly, and this is where the Hindenburg picture really becomes important, the group has short-selled not on the firm's stock value in cash, but on Adani shares are focused on international bonds. So whatever happens with the positions exposure of Adani Group to external international bonds would have a ramification on the company and the Indian stock market.
Now, as you mentioned, Adani is closely associated with Narendra Modi's India. It'll be interesting to see how the Prime Minister handles this.
So far, we've not really heard from the Prime Minister at all, of course, and much of the government administration and the popular mainstream media has not really picked up on the news. At the same time, what you would really see is that the Adani-Modi alliance has been pivotal to the government's pro-business strategy in the last 9 years. The alliance of So As to Speak goes way back to Gujarat, that is the Prime Minister's own state. And one of the things that Adani has been more importantly linked with is the oligarchic linkages and rentier profits that he had generated for infrastructure on which most of Modi's growth model and policy push has been pivoted. So my sense is that the government may want, and with the opposition pressure, you may expect that to happen, a full independent examination through SEBI and maybe even a panel to look at the allegations put forward by Hindenburg and at the same time also look at the exposure of Indian banks to Adani Group. I think the central bank has already put in an inquiry and this would be damning or denting Adani's further capital raise efforts.
Finally, Dipanshu, briefly, if you would, what do you make of the allegations and where do you see this heading?
There are two issues. One is Adani was center to the BJP's rise in pushing for private investment across sectors in India. Anything happening to the company is a big dent on the government's own policy agenda and investment push. The other thing is the underlying indicators, if you were to see on private investment in India, domestic and foreign, has been very bad. 9 years of Modi government has not seen domestic private investment really pick up. And when you have a big company like Adani's facing a stock market collapse in its share value, like the way we have seen in the last week, this will discourage many foreign investors through portfolio or direct investment to put that kind of money in India, which is, of course, a lot that has to do with the external situations also. But the internal circumstances are not going that well so far.
We shall see how it all unfolds. Dipanshu Mohan, appreciate that. Thank you. So there is our show for this week. If you'd like to comment on anything you've seen, you can tweet me at Nick Clark Al Jazz. Please use the hashtag AJCTC or just drop us an email. countingthecost@aljazeera.net is our address. But there's more for you online, of course, at aljazeera.com/CTC. That will take you straight to our page, which has individual reports, links and entire episodes for you to catch up on. So that is it for this edition of Counting the Cost. I'm Nick Clark from the whole team here. Thanks for joining us. The news on Al Jazeera is coming up.